Canada is best known for its wide expanses of forests and wilderness, millions of lakes, majestic mountains, and lush farmland. But the reality is that most of us live in cities, and many cities are trying to revitalize their downtown cores, struggling to find money to rebuild roads and bridges, and most, if not all, are choking with traffic congestion. Municipal politicians tend to move methodically, gathering support, statistics, and consensus before making changes to city streets or building a bike lane. Jeanette Sadiq Khan makes things happen at breakneck speed. For more than 6 years, she served as Transportation Commissioner for New York City. She was responsible for an intricate public transit system, thousands of miles of streets and sidewalks, millions of signs and traffic signals, hundreds of bridges, and a ferry to Staten Island. Her job was to help more than 8.5 million people move as efficiently as possible from A to B and to turn New York into a more livable city. By all accounts, she was successful. Along the way, some viewed her as courageous and visionary. Others saw her as brusque and unwilling to compromise. In 2013, she left her job as Transportation Commissioner and became a founding principal with Bloomberg Associates, founded by the former New York mayor who hired her, Michael Bloomberg. Ms. Sadiq Khan now works with mayors around the world to help them reimagine and redesign their cities. She has also co-authored a book. It's called Street Fight, Handbook for an Urban Revolution. And this morning, Jeanette Sadiq Khan is with me in our studio in Toronto. Welcome to the Sunday edition.
Thanks for having me.
Good to meet you. As I said, municipal politicians are very, very careful about how they change streetscapes or what they do with the city and so on. You call for an urban revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need a revolution?
Well, our streets are really sick when you think about it. 33,000 people die on the streets of the United States every year. We've got chronic congestion. We've got lifeless streets. And in an era where we're going to see more and more people moving to cities, the future of our planet is all about cities. So we need to rewrite the operating code of our streets and make them work more efficiently, more effectively, more sustainably. And that's the really secret sauce for cities in the 21st century.
You say in the book that the streets were built in a different age and that they badly serve today's residents.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Well, when you think about it, our streets have been in a kind of suspended animation for 60 years. And if you were in business and you didn't change your major capital asset in 50 years, you probably still wouldn't be in business. So we really need to update our streets and so they meet the needs of people today. When you think about it, our political situations have changed, culture has changed, technology has changed, and yet our streets have remained virtually the same. They don't update themselves like a smartphone. You can actually make that happen. You can do it quickly without a lot of money. And that's really what the story of Street Fight is all about.
How did we get to the point where cities, I would say every major city in North America, has ceded the streetscape to cars?
Well, we've had a kind of highway hypnosis. Streets that used to accommodate all sorts of modes of transportation. It could be the streetcar, people walking and biking. Over the years, those choices were gradually whittled away. And so we're basically left with streets that just move cars as fast
That's
as possible
right.
from point A to point B and leave people and all the other ways to get around on the side of the road. And increasingly, you're seeing world-class cities turn the corner and change that paradigm and move to a new road order that prioritizes people and choices for getting around.
But drivers are people. The people who are driving the cars are people.
Drivers are people too. And building more choices into your streets is not anti-car. It's pro-choice. And it's not a zero-sum game. You can build a bike lane and still make traffic move. You can build a bus lane and still make it safe for pedestrians. It's really important that we move beyond this myopic view of our streets so that we are accommodating all of the ways that people want to get around.
But are you talking about downtown cores? Because if you live in the suburbs, certainly in the larger suburbs of Canada, Montreal, Vancouver, Toronto, you need a car. There's very little public bus transport. You need a car to get around and to get downtown.
Yeah, it's a really important point because one of the things that we need to do is look at building strong transit networks as well. When Mike Bloomberg, as mayor, launched Plan YC, which was the city's long-range sustainability program to figure out how are we going to accommodate the million more people that were expected to move to New York City by 2030 and still continue to grow and thrive and have great neighborhoods and great commercial districts. Well, we really realized we needed to change the way we allocated space on the road, and we needed to prioritize transit and economically efficient ways of getting around. So bus rapid transit networks don't need to cost a lot of money. They can be implemented very quickly, and they can provide that kind of mobility spine that cities can depend on so that people have options of getting around without having to drive. Now, you're not going to wish people onto a bus that doesn't go fast, or wish people onto bikes when they're ridden on dangerous streets. You really do need to have an investment strategy that puts people first.
You live in Greenwich Village.
Yes.
So you have a bicycle, you could take a bus, you could take the subway, you could do all kinds of things.
Yes.
If you live out in Hicksville, you can't do that kind of stuff.
Well, that's why it's very important that our political leadership begin to understand that the planet is growing and people are moving to cities. We've got 100 million more people that are coming to cities by the year 2050. So we really need to galvanize around dense cores and actually provide that kind of framework and a housing, zoning, planning, and transportation framework that works. And that, I think, is some of the hard work, but the important framework that needs to happen.
Is it happening now? You say you're talking about cities changing the paradigm and so on, the mindset.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? How do you change something, as you said, that we've been living with for 60 years?
Well, you know, there's more to streets than just cars and stoplights and road signs. You know, streets make up more than a quarter of the public space in a given city. And they really are our front yards, but people mostly don't think about the way they're designed, and their expectations aren't for anything more than just driving the car. And so over the 6 years in New York City, we showed that this kind of transformation doesn't need to take decades and doesn't need to take billions of dollars. It can be done in weeks and months and not years.
What do you mean by creative street design? What does that mean?
Well, streets that are lively for people, streets that have lots of different ways of getting around built into them. If the only way to get around is by car, then I think you've really limited the potential of your street and the potential of your city. And the other piece is that we've got so many people that are killed and injured on our streets every year, and yet this is taken as just a fact of life in the city. Oh, well, you live in the city, you're going to be hit or killed. And so we're all about changing the status quo and building toward a new road order.
But in your tenure, you had the lowest number of fatalities in New York.
That was after the work.
After the work was done.
Yeah.
Ah, but preceding that, there were something like 700 people a year were killed.
Correct. These are basic strategies that are important for the livability, quality of life, and economic development potential of your city.
What's a road diet?
A road diet is actually when you calm down the traffic. You narrow the lanes. There's a lot of asphalt.
Oh, isn't that nice? That's a nice phrase.
There's a lot. When you think about it, there's a lot of asphalt that's basically trapped between the lanes. We've designed our streets so that they are moving at highway speed rather than the speed of life. And we don't need 12-foot lanes. You can create 10-foot lanes and then grab that extra asphalt and use it to create pedestrian refuge islands. The narrower lanes make drivers more aware of what's going on, more careful. When you design a street so that it's like a jetway, the signal to the driver is like, gentlemen, prepare your engines, prepare for takeoff. Yeah. And that's what happens.
You said in the book that, and it's an argument that has come up many, many times, I would think in every municipal council, certainly in Toronto, that if the traffic is gridlocked in three lanes, you just build another lane. Or if it's eight lanes, you build two more lanes. That doesn't work.
No, that doesn't work. And in fact, we actually have a lot of research to show that, you know, there's a saying that building more roads to solve congestion is like loosening your belt to deal with obesity. You know, it doesn't work. And the punchline is, you know, more than, you know, 50 years old, yet, you know, cities still operate with the principle that a traffic cure is just one big mega project or one more lane mile away. And now we know we can't build our way out of congestion. And if more roads reduce congestion, then Los Angeles and Houston and Dallas and Atlanta would be moving at highway speed now instead of, you know, being stuck in a sea of brake lights.
All right, bike lanes. I don't think there is anything more controversial, certainly in Toronto and elsewhere, about the establishment of bike lanes. This has been I don't want to say war, but it has been a fight, one of the biggest sort of urban warfare issues. You put in, what, nearly 400 miles mm-hmm. of bike lanes.
Mm-hmm.
How the hell did you do that?
Well, you know, a lot of people have trouble breaking the kind of bike brain barrier, the notion that our streets can be used for anything other than cars. And it's really important to build safe networks for how people can get around. It's a great transportation option. It's cheap. It's great for the environment. It's great for the pocketbook. It's great for a city. And importantly, when you put down bike lanes, you make the street safer for everyone, not just the cyclists. We found 50% decreases in injuries and fatalities along the streets where we put in protected bike lanes.
You put the bike lane between the sidewalk and parked cars. We put the bike lane beside parked cars, and it's called the door zone.
Yeah.
Because you get doored when you ride, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's you can really learn a lot from other cities. And I certainly, you know, begged, borrowed, and stole from other cities when I was transportation commissioner. And one of my first trips was to Copenhagen, and I saw what nobody in American traffic management had ever done before, which was that they took the parked cars, moved them away from the curb. Parked cars served as the barrier and created
this
bike lane.
There's a protection, yeah.
Yeah, and it did these great things. First of all, it saved the parking, which, as everybody knows, when you try to take away a parking space, it's like taking away somebody's firstborn child.
That's right.
So that's an advantage. And then you use all of that steel, those 2,000-pound cars, to provide this great protective barrier for cyclists. So it worked like a charm, and it also was really great for businesses along the way. When we created these protected bike lanes, we saw retail sales along the corridors where we put these in increase almost 50%.
Well, the myth, though, is local restaurants and businesses and stores say that it's going to ruin their business. It'll kill their bottom line.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. One of the things that we really focused on was data, and we collected data on all of the projects that we did. And for so long, our streets have been governed by anecdote rather than analysis, right? So if it would be reliable if you were a reporter and you were covering whether a bike lane was working or not, you know, you'd take, you know, your microphone and you'd go to a taxi driver and say, what do you think about it? And the taxi driver would go, not very nice stuff.
Yeah.
And but now we actually had the analysis to be able to show here's what happened to fatalities, here's what happened to injuries, here's what happened to ridership, and importantly, here's actually what happened when we looked at the sales tax receipt of small businesses, and we saw the tremendous increase in retail sales along the corridors where we put in these bike lanes. So it just shows you that better streets are better for business, and we can get our way around this, you know, one-mode mania that we've been on for 50 years and look at different ways to engineer in mobility that makes our cities much better places to live, work, and play.
A columnist for the Wall Street Journal said that you were mad ideologically, that you were a totalitarian, and my favorite was that you begrimed you begrimed the city of New York with your awful bicycles.
Yes, I remember that.
You were getting it from all sides, some sides, what?
Yeah, no, we were getting it for a while. You know, I think we really made the phrase bike lash popular. I mean, it really became a...
Bike lash?
Yes.
I've never heard that.
It was a new phenomenon, and we definitely got it from all sides. But the interesting piece was that what started to turn the tide was the polls started to come in. Poll after poll showed the support for these changes. 73% of New Yorkers supported bike share. 72% of New Yorkers supported the pedestrian plazas. 64% supported the bike lanes. If this had been an election, it would have been a landslide. And of course, you know, when people like the Wall Street Journal editorial board member did that rant and it went viral, it became kind of embarrassing to be associated with it. In fact, we actually printed little buttons that said, you know, all powerful bike lobby.
But you don't, to be fair, you don't tolerate opposition mildly, do you? I mean, you fight for what you, and you...
Yeah, anytime you take on the status quo, you challenge the status quo, it's going to be a fight, you know, and the status quo is going to push back hard. And, you know, the people that don't change it, the people that just go ahead and fill the potholes and you know, replace the signs, they have jobs for life, right?
Yeah.
But for the people that are trying to change it, to up the ante, to really improve what our streets can be and who they are for, they risk losing their jobs. But that's part of the job. Part of the job is actually changing the way that our streets move and how they perform. And again, having a really strong data focused strategy that focuses on how can we make them safer? How can we make them move better? How can we make them better for local businesses? That's part of the strategy for creating world-class cities.
Have you ever been doored?
No.
On your bicycle? Never.
No.
Really?
No.
Well, you're young yet. It may happen. My guest this morning is Jeanette Sadiq Khan. She's the former Commissioner of Transportation for New York City. She's with me in our studio in Toronto. Tell me about pedestrian plazas, pedestrian play zones, the emphasis on pedestrians. I guess all of us at one point or another, I ride a motorcycle, so
Ooh.
But I walk and I'm a pedestrian. Everyone's mm-hmm. a pedestrian, right?
Yeah, at some point during the day, yeah. Everybody's a pedestrian.
Okay, so what are these plazas all about?
You know, we actually do have a lot of opportunity that's hidden in plain sight on our streets. And, you know, we think that our streets have to be used the same way all the time, when in fact there is a lot that we can do to repurpose them. So one of the big mandates that Mayor Bloomberg put into effect was to see how we could make sure that all New Yorkers lived within a 10-minute walk of green space or open space. And our plaza program was a big part of that. And so we actually created 60 plazas all over the city and prioritized
big ones, small ones,
big ones, small yeah. ones, and particularly prioritized areas that did not have access to green space. He also was very strong about the fact that we needed to make sure that there were maintenance agreements for all of the plazas, because in the 1980s, New York created a series of pedestrian plazas, and there was no maintenance of them, and they turned into garbage pits and yeah. really undesirable yeah. spots. And so we put these maintenance agreements into place so that, you know, the local business improvement district would maintain it and take care of the tables and chairs and the plants. And in areas where there was not the economic wherewithal to be able to fund that kind of a program, we actually created a grant program and actually trained prisoners coming out of Rikers on greening, giving them a new yeah. career path, and then used formerly homeless individuals to help maintain the plazas. And so it became this very really sort of full 360-degree way to improve the quality of life for all New Yorkers.
I was in New York a few months ago, and what has happened in Times Square is, I think it's extraordinary. It's hard to describe. Well, you describe it. You did it. What did you do?
Well, so Times Square, Times Square had been a big congestion hotspot for many, many years. You know, we had traffic jams and pedlock.
You have 15,000 yellow cabs in New York.
13,000 yellow cabs.
Yeah.
And we had,
so they're all up and down.
All up and down. And we had 350,000 people walking through Times Square every day. And yet cars had 90% of the space, even though they were only 10% of the traffic. 90% of the traffic going through Times Square was on foot. So it was a street that was completely out of balance. And so people had tried to fix it for years with new slip lanes and traffic signals, and nothing worked. So I went to Mayor Bloomberg with a big idea that we were going to close Broadway from 42nd Street to 47th Street. Now, Manhattan is on a grid, north, south, east, west, and Broadway cuts diagonally.
Avenues go
through
one
it.
Way, streets go another.
Yeah, yeah. And Broadway, when it cuts through, it does these great things by, you know, creating these plazas, but it also creates these congestion hotspots because you've got three traffic signals to deal with instead of two. And so I proposed this idea to Mayor Bloomberg, and again, it was in the middle of a re-election campaign, that we were going to close Broadway. And we were going to do it as a pilot, and we were going to see if it worked. And if it worked, we'd keep it. And if it didn't work, we would put it back to the way that it was.
Now, wait a minute. You're in the room with Michael Bloomberg. You say, Mr. Mayor, I have this idea. I'm going to shut down Broadway. What was his reaction?
Well, I can't say it on air.
You say in the book, though, that he consulted every living, breathing person in Gracie Mansion. He wanted to find out everything.
No, he went to his deputies to ask yeah. what they thought, and let's just say they didn't think that it was such a great idea at the time. And he turned to me, I'll never forget this, he turned to me and he said, you know, I don't ask my commissioners to do the right thing according to the political calendar. I ask my commissioners to do the right thing, period. And with that, he shook my hand and he yeah. said, let's do it. And so we,
if it had been a fiasco, though, you would have gone back.
We would have gone back.
Advertising gone back. Or something, would
and,
you?
And he's a data-driven mayor. And yeah. so as he says, you know, trust in God, everyone else bring data.
Right.
And so we brought lots of data. We measured whether it worked from a mobility perspective, from an economic perspective, from a safety perspective. We looked at all of these different metrics, and we did a report that we issued 6 months after to report on the findings, and it worked in every regard. Injuries to motorists and pedestrians were down. Fewer people were walking in the street. it became one of the top 10 retail locations on the planet. It was a total home run. And so, again, moving quickly without a lot of money, just using paint and temporary materials, you can change the city you want to see just with a can of paint.
New York has a system of synchronized traffic lights.
Mm-hmm.
So you can drive up Park Avenue, you can drive 30 blocks on a green light sometimes. Why don't other cities do that? To me, that's a kind of simple thing.
Yeah, I don't know. But I do think that cities are increasingly sharing what works and what doesn't work with one another, and particularly with technology providing all sorts of new algorithms for moving traffic efficiently and effectively.
Or people, moving people.
Moving people. And it's really incredible to see the promise of what both autonomous vehicles and new transportation network companies like Lyft and Uber can mean for how people get around without necessarily having to have a car.
But in some cities, certainly Toronto's one, and I don't want to get stuck on traffic lights, and I'm not obsessed with it, but the light turns green, you step out, you start to cross the street, boom, it's yellow all of a sudden. You don't have time, you have to run. I mean, to me, that is, again, paying obeisance to the car.
Exactly.
Over the pedestrian.
Yeah. No, we spent a lot of time working on the timing of our signals and really prioritizing green time for pedestrians. You know, whether you're 8 or 80 years old, you should be able to cross the street safely, you know, within a cycle. And so we actually did lead pedestrian intervals where we gave pedestrians even more time to cross the street.
Are there cities that get it right, in your view?
Yeah, I think that there's an increasingly large number of cities that are recognizing that they need to move to a new road order.
Name names.
You're seeing it in a place like Los Angeles, which is building not only this great street program, but building out a bus rapid transit program, building out bike share. They're building out protected bike lanes in Los Angeles, the car capital of the world.
Los Angeles doesn't have pedestrians. Nobody walks in Los Angeles.
They do. In downtown, they do. When was the last time you were in L.A.?
15 years ago,
okay.
But I'm telling you,
it's an invitation to come again.
They have a bylaw. It's against the law to walk.
You should come down and see some of the changes that have happened in downtown. It's really impressive. And even in a place like Houston, Texas, you're seeing the surface transit renaissance. They've completely redone their bus system so that it is fast and effective and extensive. You know, you're seeing all sorts of changes in Atlanta. You know, the changes in New York and Chicago and San Francisco, the parklets.
Not once have you mentioned, because everybody always compares us to Oslo, Copenhagen, Finland, Denmark. We're always being compared to the Scandinavians, but you didn't mention one of those.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, I remember in New York when we were going through this, people would say to me, you know, we're not Amsterdam and we're not Copenhagen. And what I find so funny today is people say, like, we're not New York, which I think is a great sign.
Some people have suggested that you were kind of mugged from time to time, not so much because of your ideas, but these were ideas coming from a woman.
Coming from?
A woman. Do you buy into that? Do you
No.
buy into the gender argument?
No. I buy into the fact that I was challenging the status quo.
That was it.
And again, you know, when you push the status quo, when you push to change things, people can get really erupt.
One of your mentors, I think, was Ms. Jane Jacobs, who moved to Toronto in 1968. I was privileged to know her. And she once said that, quote, I would like it to be understood that all our human economic achievements have been done by ordinary people.
Mm.
What is the role of ordinary people in terms of redesigning cities?
Well, it's key. And in fact, a lot of the changes that we made in New York City were preceded by years and years of advocacy work, citizens coming together that tilled the ground, you know, to make it fertile for the kind of changes that we brought to bear. And the advocacy community, whether it's transportation alternatives or strap hangers campaign, and they all came together to help support these changes. And the changes that we passed in New York, you know, people think we came down with a magic wand and we just did it. You know, we have as extensive a community involvement process as you have here in Toronto. We have 59 community boards, 130 elected officials, plus 8.5 million opinionated New Yorkers. So we had a pretty big stew. And so that meant lots and lots of meetings. And so we did lots of meetings at the community level. And we started by asking communities the question, what is the problem you're trying to solve? So instead of going to a community with a baked project, we would start with that. Is your problem speeding? Well, there are lots of ways that we can adapt. So communities and ordinary people were very much engaged in this process.
It's a delight to meet you on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Why don't you follow Jane Jacobs' example and move to Toronto and sort the thing out? Come on.
I'll take it under advisement.
Do.
All
right.
You.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Jeanette Sadik Khan is the author of Street Fight, Handbook for an Urban Revolution. It's published by Viking. She's a founding principal with Bloomberg Associates in New York, and she served for more than 6 years as the city's Transportation Commissioner. You're listening to the Sunday Edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius XM Radio. My name is Michael Enright.